This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dobank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Hello, this is Fiona Porter, and today I am joined remotely by Matt Morgan and Bert Hawkins, who are both with the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. So to kick us off, could you tell me a little bit about what you both do at the NRAO?
All right. I'm Matt Morgan. I'm a research engineer at the Central Development Lab in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I head the Integrated Receiver Development Group, which is a group focused on integrating analog, digital, and photonic technologies to build radio astronomy instrumentation, really for the next generation of radio telescopes. We do a number of different things in this group. We develop instrumentation. We did some development for ALMA. We are working on NGVLA prototype designs. We are working on some spectrum monitoring hardware for some future radio dynamic zone instrumentation. We also splinter off some technologies from time to time for commercialization, which is kind of a new thrust at NRAO, and that's been exciting for us. So we found a lot of the stuff that we developed for radio astronomy actually has broader applications outside of just radio astronomy, which is an interesting sort of a side aspect of the work that we do.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So I'm Bert Hawkins. I'm the director of the Central Development Lab. Matt's team is part of our laboratory. The CDL has the mission under NRAO to develop the next generation of technology for radio telescopes. So we work across a broad front of technologies from the front of the telescope at the antenna, all the way to the back end, to the correlator. We're developing a number of new technologies these days and improving current ones. CDL consists of about 50 engineers and technicians and specialists.
All right, lovely. So to kick us off, we've had some very interesting talks from both of you at the department's colloquium. One of the things which I find particularly interesting is that obviously as a facility you are up and running again, and because of that you needed to put some stuff into place to make sure the facility is safe for working while COVID's on. Would you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, Tony Beasley, the director of NRAO, made a call early on to keep the observatory open. One of the parts of NRAO is a very large baseline array, and it has a mission with national implications, and places like CDL and other parts of the observatory support that part of the observatory. So we had a national mission to keep going, and we also wanted to keep the VLA running as well. So we did have an infectious disease policy in place when this started. So we started out with a skeleton crew at all the sites, just making sure all the essential services were running. And then those who could work from home were directed to work from home. And that started in mid-March, and it went pretty well after a rough start. Everyone figured out how to Zoom and work remotely. But we realized we had to get the folks in who could not work from home. These are technicians and bench engineers and things like that. So working very closely with our safety officer and all the managers across the observatory, we came up with protocols to protect people, and we started slow and very carefully. At CDL, for example, we mapped our facilities against the HVAC zones, the heating and ventilation zones that we had. And we thought we would start off by having just one worker in each HVAC zone. That way they could work without a mask and there would be no chance of contamination. So that started us off on what we called our return to full operations mode. We had several phases planned for that. Phase one was what I just described, bringing in people a few at a time and keeping them safe. We got better and better at this, and as we learned more and more about the virus and people got better at following the protocols, we were able to bring even more people in. We reconfigured lab spaces. Unused offices were converted to labs. By the use of masks and other things, we were able to get more than one person in an HVAC zone. Our safety officer even bought a supplied air system, which we affectionately call a moon suit, where you don a hood and a hose connected to a air pump outside. And that allowed us to actually do some shoulder-to-shoulder training. We have some new people who needed you know, training in the lab, being shown how to work the equipment, and there's no way to do that without, you know, being in close proximity to each other.
There's some things that, say, videos or Zoom calls really just can't quite compare to.
Right, exactly. And it had to be done, and everyone was very good about trying new things out and working through problems, and there were tons of suggestions from the staff at CDO, and we were able to implement many of them. So we're recovering over 90% of our efficiency these days as far as people coming in and working. We don't have too many people who cannot work one way or another, so we're pretty proud of that. Now we're bracing ourselves. We seem to have another wave coming through, so we're looking at how to keep people safe. But so far, we're doing okay.
And it does sound like the protocols you've put into place, they sound like the sort of stuff which can, if it's necessary, be sort of wound back to a bit. So you can, again, go back to having, say, just one person in each of those HVAC zones.
That's exactly what we're thinking because, of course, if you have multiple people in an HVAC zone and one of them tests positive, protocol says, you know, the ones who share the HVAC zone need to go in quarantine. So there's a loss of efficiency in doing that. So that's exactly what we're looking at. So we can kind of scale these measures depending on how bad the virus is propagating through the community.
Makes sense. And it is really good to hear that, you know, even with the pandemic going on, we're not necessarily losing all potential for this sort of science to keep going.
No, we continue to make progress. It is slow. There's a lot of inefficiency built in, and there was frustration, but I think people have resigned themselves that, you know, you have to get done what you can get done during this time, and we will get back to normal, and as much as we can do now, the better.
I could add that NRAO has invested in some, you know, some small amount in equipment to kind of help do this. My own technician, who's very industrious, has found good ways to sort of bring me virtually into the lab with him. He has purchased some cameras and even microscope cameras and things like that with a USB hookup. And so I can call in on Zoom and he can share his screen with this microscope camera and I can be sort of virtually right there with him and actually working on some things. And that's been an interesting alteration in how we work, but we've managed to work our way through it. So
I can imagine. I had no idea that, I had no idea that microscope cameras were a thing, but I suppose thinking about it, it does make sense, especially in scenarios like this. It's going to be very useful.
Yeah, Matt's team's a good example of that. They were creative before the pandemic, and when the pandemic came, they turned their creativity to things like that. It's been really great to watch.
Well, speaking of creativity, I suppose we can then move on to basically what are the big projects going on at the NRAO right now? I imagine one of them is the next generation VLA.
That's exactly right. That's our next flagship telescope, and we're very excited about it. CDO has several roles to play in that. One of the most important is Matt's team, so I'll defer to him in just a moment. But as I mentioned, CDO covers the entire swath of technology used in a radio telescope. So our electromagnetics engineer is working on feed horns and the analysis of the antennas. You may know, for a large array like that, the antennas represent about half the cost, so you have to put a lot of time and energy into getting that right. We're working there immediately after that. Matt's team takes over, and he'll talk about that. But we also have a team working on the timing that's required and distribution of signals, now over a 1,500-kilometer or so baseline. So that's a very difficult task, so we're looking at technologies and looking for partners in that. Our digital and correlator team is also working on an entirely next generation of correlator that could be used for the NGVLA. So we're working across several fronts. And I'll let Matt talk about what his team is doing, which is a real integral part of NGVLA.
Just before we go on to that, might do a little bit of stuff for our listeners who aren't quite as familiar with the VLA. So start us off. VLA is a radio array. And I understand that the NGVLA will be quite a significant update in the number of dishes involved. Something like, it's currently got about 27 dishes, am I right?
Right. So the VLA, I believe, just had its 40th anniversary. So it is in New Mexico. I understand it's one of the most productive scientific instruments there's ever have been. It was a very important radio telescope, a reconfigurable array, baselines out to 20 kilometers or so. Yes, so the idea is to update the VLA to complement all the other things going on in astronomy, to give us the spectral resolution and the angular resolution and to complement all the other things that are going in the optical and infrared world and space-based telescopes. So we want milliarc second resolution on that, and we want to use symmetric wave observations, which allow you to do the things the NGLA wants to do, which is look at planet formation and astrobiology and the evolution of galaxies and things like that. Well, when you want that kind of resolution and you want that kind of sensitivity, you find yourself building some 250-plus dishes spread out over 1,500 kilometers or so. So, you know, the current VLA occupies a plane there of about 20 kilometers or so. So we're going to expand that out into, you know, West Texas to the east and up into Colorado in the north and into eastern Arizona to the west. And there's even a plan to put some of these antennas into northern Mexico. When you start putting these baselines down on a map of the western United States, that's kind of the extent of it. And then eventually the idea is to make it compatible and connected to the current VLBA, which is continental-wide, 10-dish array, you know, to make a very large array, a very, very large array, I guess. I'm not sure if they coined a name for that, but they want NGVLA to integrate the current VLBA.
Honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if the name wound up being the very, very large array. It sounds very astronomy.
Yes, it does. That seems to be the way they do this, yeah.
Okay, so heading back to what we were talking about before, a bit more about what exactly is going on in terms of the technology.
Right, and I'll let Matt talk about his receiver team because they're doing a lot of very interesting things.
Sure. So, the IRB group for NGVLA is focused really on the warm electronic packages. So as in most radio telescopes, there's a cryogenic front end, which is not our portion, but that feeds our portion, which is the rest of the warm electronics that take the amplified sky frequency signal, if you will, and does all the down conversion and the conversion from analog to digital and the conversion from copper to fiber to transmit the data off the telescope over these long distances. One of the driving requirements for an array of this size is that the operations and maintenance cost has to be significantly less per antenna than it was for like the very large array. And so that sort of drove us to this modular design where you can pack a lot of electronics into relatively small modules that you can hold in your hand or an assembly of those modules into a large field replaceable unit. And so that's one of the reasons that I think the IRB concept, this integrated electronics concept, was so important to the NGVLA. So we're developing electronics. There was also a lot of requirement for very broad instantaneous bandwidth. So we're developing electronics to digitize large swaths of bandwidths, covering a range of about 1.2 to 116 gigahertz. And so we've sort of chopped that up into six receiver bands, and we're developing all the warm electronics packages for that. And we look very closely at replication cost because you multiply it out, and you're talking about 10,000 modules or something like that to complete the array. And so we have to be able to mass produce these. They have to be maintainable, and they have to not consume too much power or generate too much self-interference at the antenna. So those are the kinds of things that that we focus on. And so we're developing the analog electronics. We're also developing some custom digitizers, which is something I talked about in my talk, to help digitize those broad bandwidths and get the data off the telescope as quickly as possible with the minimum power dissipation and the minimum risk of self-interference.
If I remember rightly, one of your talks mentioned that you've been working on setting some pieces up so they can just be 3D printed. Am I remembering that right?
Right. We made a decision about a year or so ago that there was so much going on in 3D printing and the advances were coming so fast that we thought we should keep an eye on that field because we had not paid much attention to it. So we started a research and development or at least an investigation program to look at where that technology is going. Now, you know, radio astronomy does amazing things. The signals we chase are extremely weak. And over the last 100 years or so, the radio astronomy community has developed some very specialized techniques in order to capture these signals. So the technology is so specific to the mission of chasing these weak signals is that even slight variations in performance or shape or reproducibility can have huge implications. So one of the things we're looking at is just the fundamental properties of some of these 3D printed pieces. We hold such tight tolerances and ask so much of our equipment because our signals are so weak that it really has to be spectacular. So much of our stuff is handmade, literally, hand finished. So the question we're trying to answer is, will 3D printing ever get to the point where it can produce things that rival what we can make by hand? Or can they produce things in different ways that would make it advantageous for us to use 3D printing for something that we would normally, build by hand? And you can kind of see where this might be a use, where Matt was talking about economies of scale that goes on when you're building something like NGVLA. You're talking about tens of thousands of pieces. It's impractical to handcraft all of those. So if we could find some pieces that could be 3D printed, or we could find that via 3D printing, we could eliminate some things that we have to build. So I admit it's a bit nebulous on exactly what we're looking for from 3D printing, but there are such advances being made in materials and techniques that we think one day it may be applicable to radio astronomy. So we are evaluating a number of pieces. We've signed a couple of memorandums of cooperation with some of the leaders in the field. And we think over the next 5 years or so, there may be the possibility that 3D printing will have a role in radio astronomy.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was thinking, especially when you were talking, Matt, about, tens of thousands of pieces being needed. I mean, the thought that they're all being made by hand is, that must be quite time consuming.
I was going to say that a lot of the technologies that go into these modules are sort of derived from mass producible technology. So we do a lot of mimic chips, for example, that are made on wafers in quantities of thousands, or we do circuit boards, which is a big mass production industry already. We haven't ourselves done so much of the machine assembly, right? So we still have our technicians in the lab do manual wire bonding and stuff, but the designs are put together in such a way that they could then be put into an automated manufacturing process, an automated wire bonder, for example. We haven't done a whole lot of that. We did some of that for the ALMA telescope, actually, was sort of our first experience with that, and it's something we're counting on quite a bit for the NGVLA, actually, because we just don't have the personnel to manufacture those kinds of things in that quantity. So our current plan really is that we build the prototypes, we test them, we characterize them, we do whatever troubleshooting we need, but then we do an external contract to a contract manufacturer to do the automated assembly and the automated wire bonding and that kind of thing.
Yeah, one of the exciting things to keep an eye on with NGVLA is it is such a large scale that it presents whole new challenges to the observatory that we haven't had to face before, and I think that's part of the excitement of it. If you think about, now when you wake up and you have to repair to VLA, you might have a 20-kilometer ride out to the latest, to the farthest antenna. But if you wake up in Socorro and you have to repair an antenna all the way across the state into Arizona, how do you do that with 200 of those and a certain breakdown rate? How do you configure the logistics, and how do you build your components so that the failure rate is so low that you're not just constantly, driving across the southwestern part of the United States repairing things? So there's a whole nother aspect of operations and logistics when you build a radio telescope that large, which is, I think, really animating a lot of the plan and design of this.
I can imagine. So in that case, when the sort of more distant stations come online, they're still going to be maintained from sort of the NRAO central. There's not going to be sort of little local stations which look after them.
I think some of that's to be determined, but there will be a NGVLA headquarters in New Mexico, potentially in Albuquerque. And they're working out now exactly how you service all those antennas and how you maintain them. And of course, the goal is to make them very low maintenance, which is where Matt comes in. You know, he's integrating a lot of pieces that used to be separate, and we're hoping that they're more reliable and durable and resilient because of that.
I think also it depends on the type of repair that needs to be done. So like the modules we built, for example, you really wouldn't want to open them up and work on them out in the field, right? You need to have them in a clean laboratory with the right ESD protection, the right kinds of equipment and stuff like that. So I think our goal really is to make modules and have spares that we can deliver then to the field teams, I guess, that would take them out and replace them on the telescope. But the more delicate kinds of repairs inside the module would be done at a more centralized location or possibly back at the CDL in Charlottesville.
So it's kind of like the idea of when something goes wrong in a particular module, you just swap it out with a replacement which should do exactly the same job, and then take the original back home, figure out exactly what went wrong with it, if it's something you need to worry about more in the future, that sort of thing.
Yeah, let me pick up on something Matt mentioned earlier too, which is another aspect of NGVLA that's interesting and kind of new. You know, up to this point, at least for NRAOs, you know, we've put our telescopes in places with very little interference. You know, Green Bank Observatory, which used to be part of NRAO, is actually in a radio quiet zone in West Virginia. And the VLA, of course, is in a very remote part of New Mexico, so there's not a lot of radio interference there. ALMA, of course, is on the top of a mountain in northern Chile in a very remote part of the world, operating at frequencies where there are practically no interferers. So, you know, you could get by without dealing with too much interference of commercial or other signals in your observation path. Now, when you look at NGVLA, which would be spread out over the area I was just talking about, you know, in the 2030s is when we think this will be operating. And you project all the advances that are being made in communications and RF technology, thinking about 5G. We'll probably be on the 6G or whatever comes next by the time NGVLA comes online. And all the satellite-based worldwide internet services coming online, and car radars, and all the things that technology is bringing. There's a great potential for serious RF interference. So Matt said one of the things his team is also working on is a series of receivers that can monitor the radio spectrum and with them first step to try to mitigate that kind of thing. So that's another aspect of NGVLA that's going to be new that we're going to have to deal with, and some technology is going to have to be involved in that, and some legislation and cooperation and collaboration with commercial folks and the government and things like that. So yeah, when you start to expand the size and scale of these projects, you pick up whole new missions that you have to deal with. And CDL is wading into that with both feet. We're excited about some of those missions.
Well, that also reminds me of something else that came up in the talk, I believe. So in the US, you've got some sort of protected radio zones, the radio quiet zones, like you mentioned, that Green Bank's in one. But what also came up in the talk was a dynamic radio zone, which is theoretically sort of the opposite of the radio quiet zone.
It is, right. So, yeah, picking up from, you know, what I was just talking about, radio interference with NGVLA, is people have finally realized, particularly the National Science Foundation, you know, which is operates the NRAO through a cooperative agreement, and represents and funds a lot of the scientific use of spectrum, both in radio astronomy and remote sensing for, you know, earth science and things like that. You know, that they have the mission to take care of all that. So they realize that the huge increase in technology that's coming as far as wireless technologies, all the things I just mentioned, could be viewed as on a bit of a collision course with these passive scientific users. So they have started a couple of initiatives to try to figure out coexistence in the future with the commercial and military and other expanding uses of these frequencies. With the passive scientific users, you know, we both must do our mission. They're both important. So we're beginning to start in the U.S. to have a entity that would help collaborate and coordinate on all that. So the NSF is currently working on that. One part of that collaboration and vision for the future is a national radio dynamic zone, which would indeed be just the opposite of the national radio quiet zone. It would be an area where, some geographical area, the size to be determined, where if you're developing new technologies on new frequencies and new modulation schemes and new powers, where you could bring it and operate it and test it out in an area where it would not interfere with, you know, the existing infrastructure of communications and use of spectrum. So it'd be a safe spot, if you will, if you wanted to try out a new technology that perhaps was designed to operate in a frequency band used by someone else, but sense the spectrum and avoid interference dynamically or something like that. So you just wouldn't want to test that out in the open, because it could interfere with critical infrastructure like radar or communications between aircraft or something like that. So you need a safe spot to test all this technology and to test compatibility. So there is a vision for a national radio dynamic zone to do all that. And NRAO would play a part in this, right? We would want to see how that technology could be used to be able to mitigate our RF interference that we anticipate. So the National Radio Dynamic Zone will be an area set aside so that users of the spectrum, both passively and actively, can come in and develop the techniques and the tools and the mechanisms to share the spectrum in the future.
All right. Okay. I think to sort of wrap all this up, I'm going to go back to something which Matt mentioned right at the start. Since we're talking about commercial use of radio, why don't we talk about some of the commercial use that the NRAO is finding for its work?
Yeah, many years ago, I think NRAO decided that we develop a lot of these technologies for our own purposes, but they actually have broader application outside of radio astronomy. And we're actually encouraged by our funding organizations to transfer our technology to a commercial use whenever possible, whenever can be used. And so we started looking around and thinking about how to do that, and NRAO created a tech transfer office to sort of facilitate that. And really the first most successful implementation of that was a technology developed in the IRD group called reflectionless filters. This was something that we developed to solve a problem with the radio telescope instrumentation that we were building, but everybody, you know, in electronics uses filters, and so we kind of lifted our heads up and looked around and said, well, who else might use this? Well, a lot of people might use it. And so I was encouraged to seek a patent for that and did that. And since then, there have been a number of follow-up patents with various improvements. And we started looking around at maybe trying to sell them, see if somebody would want them, to kind of help offset our own budgets. We were moderately successful for that, but we really weren't set up as an organization to commercialize things directly. So we ended up finding a partner in Mini Circuits who has now licensed the technology and has made it more widely available. And so that's been a very beneficial partnership for us. And we're kind of looking for the next technology that might have a similar broad application. Some of the digitizer technology I talked about in my talk is one possibility, and we've patented a number of other things that have come out of this as well. I think if, you know, a lot of people in this field feel like radio astronomy is so specialized that a lot of what we do, it's hard to transfer to industry. And in a lot of cases, that's true. But I think really, if we thought more creatively about it, I think there's also a lot of what we do has broader applications, particularly at the component level. And that's really where we've been able to do this successfully. So that's been exciting for me. It's not something I expected to do when I joined NRAO, but it's been an interesting sort of aspect of my work that I didn't anticipate, that I've enjoyed quite a bit. And I've made some good contacts at Mini Circuits and other industries, and they've been very useful and educational for me. Actually, I've learned a lot about a commercial world that I never expected to be in when I was going to college. So,
I've always thought it was really interesting that when it comes down to it, a lot of sort of the cutting edge astronomical tech, I think that while we're working with it directly, we often think, well, this is so hyper specialized, this is so field relevant that it doesn't really have any impact on the broader world. But I think when you look at it, a lot of a lot of inventions which have come just during the course of other studies, just during the course of working on things in science, have ended up being something just really fundamental to the modern world. I mean, thinking of, for example, the moon missions, the sort of technology required to, say, work on miniaturization, making things lighter so it can be, there's less weight for rockets to have to handle. I think, like, we're still seeing the impact of that down the line, although we might not even recognize them as being related.
I think one of the interesting things about developing technologies like that is people don't know they need them until it's available, right? So you develop something that they didn't ask for, and in a way it kind of forces you to rethink how you develop the system. It's like, well, now I have this component that I didn't know I could have. How can I re-engineer my system around it to make a better system? And I've actually talked about that with many of our partners at MiniCircuits, that customer education is actually one of their chief thrusts here. We think we have a great product, and a lot of customers have caught on and said, yeah, I can really use this. Whereas other ones who are used to solving problems different ways are still using sort of the traditional approach to system design and haven't realized that, well, you can re-engineer your system from the ground up with these new components.
I guess the sort of broad takeaway from this is just, in all aspects, flexibility is key, isn't it?
Right, absolutely.
Well, thank you both very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure.
This has been a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. To find out more, visit jodcast.net.